Okay, we might as well get started. My name is Charles Severance. I am a faculty member at the University of Michigan. I am a contractor consultant for the IMS Global Learning Consortium, which is the organization that makes standards like QTI and IMS Common Cartridge and IMS Content Packaging. And I'm going to talk to you about a couple things. I'm going to talk to you about this learning tools interoperability standard that we are building at this point in time, plus all the hacking that I'm doing sort of at the same time. You have to be a member to actually be part of the IMS standards process, which Michael Feldstein and I argued a bit about on the web, and we finally actually agreed. And that's in the earliest stages of making a standard, you really need about four people in a quiet room and let them fight it out, and then they show it to, you know, the next 30 people, and then you show it to everybody. And so this standard is in the phase of fighting it out with four people in a room, and I'll tell that sort of story when we get to that. So I want to start out with some basic definitions. I claim to have invented the word functionality mashup. When you come up with some new crazy idea like, say, community source, for example, you make up some weird word that Google doesn't know about yet, and then you call that yourself, and then you can see by reference over time, it's like a globally unique identifier. So I made up functionality mashup, and so if you Google functionality mashup, you mostly come to junk that I've been like beating this drum for a very long time. So anyone who uses the word, they just kind of get my page rank up more and more and more. So content mashup is something that we've been doing for a long time. It's really taking data from one place and using it in another place. Functionality mashup is the idea of taking interactive software from one place and using it in a completely different context. But now we're really talking live running interactive software. We're not talking about just a bit of data that you might cache or store locally. We're talking about usable software. Learning tools interoperability sort of builds on this quite a bit, because what we've done and seen so far in functionality mashup just really is not adequate for what we need to do for learning, because most of the functionality has very little identity or identification information. And it really is not sufficient for our own needs to build tools and use them in our learning management systems. So the classic content mashup is RSS feeds. And one of the things we learn about mashup is that you've got to make it as easy as possible to do. It used to be, you know, years ago, like in 1990, RSS was kind of complex and tricky, and you got some software, but now it's built into like every web browser on the planet, and there's when you run into a site that happens to support RSS in addition to HTML, you get this little RSS indicator on your web browser, and then you click on it, and the browser actually is an RSS reader. So this is an example of data that was retrieved and then completely formatted and presented to you by your browser rather than the markup coming from them. And basically this RSS feed can go anywhere, and we use this in our teaching. We grab headlines or a searched and sorted version of headlines. Some folks use RSS as a way to pull data from Sakai to put it into their portal. They'll just pull a little RSS feed that includes recent announcements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we do functionality mashup all the time. Maps is the classic functionality mashup application. We use Google Maps so often, so much, that we just think it's just another part of most web pages. But in reality, the part in the rectangle is really running on all the Google servers, and Google takes care of all the stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But really, we have two complete different servers and services. The Google Maps are kind of in the cloud somewhere, and we don't care. And the Holiday Inn, they sort of just include the Google Maps. Now, you might think that this is really easy and really trivial. Oh. I'll get back to the trivial bit in a second. So YouTube is another example of functionality mashup. Here's a little bed and breakfast that has a video, and of course we do this in our teaching. And one of the things I just absolutely love about YouTube is that if you wander to YouTube and you find this same video, they are always promoting the mashup. So they are always saying to you, please copy and paste this HTML into your page somewhere, because they've built something of value. And then they want you to reuse it and then point to them so that, of course, when the bed and breakfast video is done for your particular bed and breakfast, up comes some ads for the bed and breakfasts that are nearby and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But you're really winning, because most of the time they watch the first 30 seconds of the video anyways, and you're getting something for free. You have a real simple site, and all that video conversion YouTube does. And so that's the kind of idea of functionality mashup. The problem is that for learning, again, this only works for resources where there's identity. Here's an example of a Holiday Inn that's got a broken website. So in this middle area where there was supposed to be a map, it says, forbidden. Your client does not have permission to get the URL, blah, 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 from this server. And that's because when you use Google Maps, you exchange this key and you tell them what server it is that's going to use Google Maps. And that's because if all of a sudden you start causing all kinds of trouble with Google Maps, they want to know who to call to say stop using us or go to the pay service or whatever it is. So there's actually identity going back and forth every single time a Google Maps comes up. It's not really your individual identity. Of course, if you're signed on to Google, then they do know who you are. But if it's just coming to Holiday Inn, they don't at least know who the sysadmin of this server is, who it was that effectively placed that software in the middle of the Holiday Inn page. Now, something obviously changed. They moved servers or something changed. They forgot to update the key or they changed the key and didn't put it in. And that's what happens because when Google's bringing a map up, the first thing it does is cha-cha-cha. Who are you? Are you the right person? I'm tracking you. How many times have you hit me? Maybe I'll shut you off if you're doing it. Looks like you're denial of service or something like that. So there's identity going on. The problem is that what we need in learning tools interoperability for learning, this same kind of capability for learning, is we need far more information than what we get, i.e. which server it is. We want to know which student it is, what class it is, etc. And then we have a whole series of privacy issues. So sometimes you need to know what student it is, but you can't know who that student is. You just only know identity, for example. You know that here's some unique identifier, kind of like Shibboleth, where if this same student re-arrives, they'll have this number. And if they re-arrive from this class, they'll have this student number and this class number, but you cannot figure out what class it is and you cannot figure out what student it is just having those things. But you do know if they come back, they will give you the same number. Now, Facebook is really pushing the envelope. So I use Google Maps as the example, but Facebook is really the best example of this because Facebook is starting to exchange identity. And so Facebook is the model that we're starting to follow. And IMS Learning Tools Interoperability was very much inspired by Facebook on a couple of dimensions. The fact that it's easy, the fact that it's simple to write these things, the fact that the developer documentation is, 30 or 40 pages long. And so we figured that why would we start a standard at this point in time that was like old and crufty? We had to be as good as Facebook, if not better. So our lead on the specification is Bruno von Haitsdale from WIMBA. We started with Microsoft, Chris Moffitt of Microsoft as the other lead, and recently Chris has become busy and Blackboard's picked up as the co-lead of this. And the idea is I'm going to show you some real simple things, but the ultimate learning tools interoperability is a way to plug all the way into the deepest part of a learning management system, including the add resource, configure resource. So it's not just the functionality, but the configuration of the functionality, the placing of the functionality. That's all in this standard. So we have a couple of different use case scenarios that we're interested in and we support. So one of them is where there is a tool. Let's just take a piece of publisher content, for example, and the university sort of licenses this publisher content, and there's an administrator of the learning management system and an administrator of the publisher content, and it's like, okay, do we trust each other? And hang on, let's all get on the phone and let's exchange a couple of secrets. And then when it's all said and done, the administrator of the learning management system installs this tool right into the system. When you're using the tool, you don't even know that it's not on your system. You just add a tool to your site. It's completely pre-configured with where that content is, what the secret password is, all the secret keys, sometimes the secret keys for that system to call your system back and do things like set grades late at night or upload usage information or whatever. So this is a very heavy, highly secure system admin to system admin kind of relationship. The second use case is really my favorite use case as a teacher, because I'm all about empowering teachers, not just empowering system administrators, because those system administrators don't always do what I want as quickly as I want. I'd like to upgrade every night when I have a patch to our production server so I can put features in very rapidly. But they don't seem to like that. I mean, I'm about, I don't, When I switched from being, you know, chief architect of Sakai to a teacher, they said, do you want like an administrator password on the production system? I said, no, I don't, because you're going to start blaming me for like everything if you give me an administrator password. So I go to tech support like everybody else, and I'm nice to them, and I say, could you do me a little favor on my site? It's always good in any conspiracy to have at least co-conspirators so that you have sort of, you know, somebody to blame if something goes wrong. So the second one is actually the use case for me. And that is, I want it under control, the instructors. Now, we understand that perhaps we instructors aren't going to be allowed to release all of the data of the institution to some random Perl script sitting out there somewhere on the internet. So we have a bunch of security things built in to sandbox the instructor use of this. So the administrators do get to come down and sandbox the instructors from, say, giving away names. Or at least they have to go ask someone else to give away names and identities and rosters so that they can check to make sure that it's really Pearson and not just some PHP script on the internet that's scraping for Facebook entries. Another way to think about this is you get a publisher content, and the common cartridge work is getting actually pretty mature. You're starting to be able to see common cartridges, IMS common cartridges, which are pretty much core structures in a box, threaded discussions and content and interlinked content and test questions and all those things, all like in one big zip file. So it's like, yay, this is great. We're going to go get some of these done. Let's start making some. And they turn out to be 100 megabytes, 200 megabytes, 300 megabytes. And all of a sudden, you just can't send them around an email anymore. And now when like the poor teacher's uploading a 300 megabyte thing on a click to upload button, everybody's getting a little bit crazy. So the pattern, and I don't know if you saw the McGraw-Hill work, the pattern is to send around a cartridge. McGraw-Hill's not using the common cartridge, but it's the same idea. You send around a cartridge that has sort of the editable things you want to fiddle with, but not the giant media files, not the giant flash files that are the, you know, slides, etc. And so basically, you send out this zip file. It's like 200K, and it's got all the fun stuff, the table contents, and all that kind of stuff in it, and the threaded discussion, and a lot of stuff that compresses very nicely, and the 150, 250, or whatever megabytes of multimedia content that you may or may not want to store on your local server, may or may not even want to use, you leave that back there, but put little tool interoperability plugs in here so that when it starts up, it effectively sends the identity information to the publisher, establishes that you've paid for it, etc., and then shows it right then and there. And so the loading of a tool by the instructor is kind of a partially provisioned website. So in the first scenario, the administrator installs a tool. It looks to the end users like any other tool. There's just completely not, it's just, hey, it's there. Now, the administrator can, at the point where they install this, they can configure a sandbox that says, this tool, Pearson, we're not going to give, we're going to give Pearson name and password, name and first name, last name, and class name, but we're only going to give McGraw-Hill opaque identity. Check, 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 check. You may, in this scenario, give the external tool permission to asynchronously connect back. So it's not really coming in as a user anymore. It is coming in as a system-to-system relationship. And it's so far that you might go to Wimba and then click, 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 and it'll say, what school are you from? And it'll pull up your school list. What course are you teaching at that school? And then you say, charge my credit card $500 and install the Wimba voice chat into the course and my school. And you actually never hardly logged into your LMS, but the next time you log into your LMS, poof, it pops up. Now, that's kind of an exaggerated use case, but it gives you the sense of the breadth of power we have in this mashup where the tool can actually inject itself into the learning management system if there's enough trust relationship between those two systems. So the instructor mashup, of course, is the riff on YouTube where you're wandering across something. I'm working with a fella out of Washington State who's got some math practice questions for K-12 students, and we're working on it. It's all free. He's got some grant or something. He'd like to know who you are. He'd like to know what school you're coming from. And so you can go over there, sign up a couple things, maybe reply to an email, and then he'll give you a URL and a password. You'll paste it into the tools interoperability, mash up, and away you go. So here's an example of a sandbox. I stole this right out of Facebook. So basically, you know, that's what happens when you add something to Facebook. It adds, am I going to allow this application to know who I am, put a box in my profile, place a link in my left-hand navigation, publish stories in my newsfeed, place a link below the profile picture on any profile, send me notifications via email. So what I did basically is I installed this piece of software just enough to get a screenshot, and then I deinstalled it because I was terrified of what it was going to do. It was actually the Star Trek personality quiz or something. What I don't know is, like, what happens to Facebook tools when you only give it a little permission? Do they blow up? Do they say, like, sorry, I can't run without the ability to post things in your newsfeed? They do that? Yeah, they're just, it's like, it's actually, that's kind of like how it is sometimes when you're talking to publishers in the IMS working group. They'll say, like, what do you mean? You won't just, like, give me a straight database connection to your learning management system database and let me write into it? I mean, don't you want the grades back? And it's like, I know you're big, and I know we're small, especially like community colleges and stuff are small, but real system administrators don't like giving people on the internet access to their database directly. So this is also the sandbox that you can kind of wrap inheritance of sandbox around the instructor mashup. So the instructor might be sandboxed herself, but then be able to, within that, a few things they can actually decide whether to give or not. And then you also, you know, kind of following Sakai way, you come up with a way to go beg the tech support people to let you send first name and last name, and then they would open your sandbox up a little bit, and you can open up the sandbox, and all of a sudden your students' first names and last names will be going to this little math thing from this guy in Washington, so that when they're practicing math, it says, you know, hello, Bobby, you seem to be your little bad on single variable algebra. So the common cartridge I mentioned will have these little tiny pre-provisioned tools interoperability widgets. And some will be to trusted sites, and so all of a sudden that will seem like a lot more information is going back and forth, because, you know, if Pearson is there and all of a sudden Pearson cartridges start showing up and pointing back to Pearson cartridges, there's no reason to sort of separately negotiate what we're allowed to give Pearson, because the admin already has agreed to Pearson. On the other hand, if the cartridge is coming in and it's going to somewhere, pointing back to some cartridge that the admin has never seen before, we're going to put tracking in so you'll be able to see, whoa, IMS tools interoperability has been popping up here. We got one going to, you know, 216.41.63.48 or whatever, right? And so we want to be able to track this because we know that it'll be a little bit scary for people, and culturally they may not want to turn it on. There's a talk later something about, like, the link tool, social implications of the link tool, and I think that's like, you know, who do you want to be sharing your data with? And that's the real issue. But we're trying to write this protocol and this technology not to try to decide what the policies are before, because that's really fruitless. Otherwise, if you work at the most restricted set of policies, you end up with worthless software. So you just build software that's capable of this big, and then you put policies on top of that. So one of the things we've done in the tools interoperability specification is we've evolved the spec for a year and a half, and we've been writing prototypes all along. So I'm going to show you some screenshots of code that doesn't even exist anymore because we've been writing and throwing prototypes away. But it really informs the specifications. One of the things IMS wants to do is make these specifications adopted much more rapidly after they're released, and it turns out that just makes it a lot slower to create these specifications, but it does produce specifications that are much better when they're done. So in the first phase, and I'll tell you about the next phase, it was led by Wimba. We had code running in Moodle, Blackboard, Sakai, SharePoint. All those things were consuming functionality mashup. And we had Icodian, ScormPlayer, Wimba, and uCompass as producing. And we could really mash up any combination of those learning systems. And I got some screenshots here. This is an example of a Blackboard building block. Now, the interesting thing is we took the approach of just making a building block. We didn't ask Blackboard whether we could do this or not. We just made a building block. So this is Wimba running into an old version of Blackboard. This is Icodian running into Moodle. This is Wimba running in SharePoint. How many people have all kinds of little SharePoints popping up all around? Yeah? SharePoint? Yeah. SharePoint's like the new viral thing. You know, you put up an Active Directory and then people just start putting up SharePoints and they start sharing documents and then they go like, what should we do with this? Microsoft actually likes that a lot. And so we've actually built a tools interoperability for Microsoft. Here is Wimba running in Sakai. Here is uCompass. uCompass is a really interesting company. They have this really Web 2.0 view of teaching and learning. The way you put a learning object into this is a uCompass learning object repository, you mail it to them in Gmail, and they mail you back a URL, and then when you go to that URL, it gives you a quiz. You can take the quiz, right? It's like, wow, that's kind of cool, actually. You mail it a zip file of an Omnis content package, it unzips it and gives you a URL back. It's not a shipping product. Ed Mansouri, who's the chief geek there, is just, this is his like crazy pet project, and it's so brilliant that it's like, okay, so why do we use this? But you see it as brilliant as soon as you look at it. So basically, phase one, we spent a year and a half, and I thought we were almost done with the standard about 2 months ago. And then Blackboard showed up and showed us the proxy tool. The next generation of Blackboard is basically going to have tools interoperability kind of built in from the bottom up. They'd been part of the group for a long time, but at the same time, they've been engineering their own solution. And just in time for almost us to be done with the solution that we'd come up with, they gave us their solution. And so we had a couple beers, and we thought about it for a while, and we thought, yeah, it's probably a good idea to actually look at what they're presenting to us. They spent some time thinking about it. And Pearson arrived at the same time, and Pearson has a thing they call TPI, which is a very mature mashup, but it's also rather publisher-centric. They really dictate to the learning management system how things are. So we decided to sort of bring everybody in, and as long as people behaved and moved quickly, we said the WIMBA and that crew that had built the sort of first phase of the document, said, that's okay, we want to hear what you have to say. And it's been really great. In 8 weeks, we're almost caught back up to where we were 8 weeks ago with the WIMBA spec. And so Blackboard has been, Blackboard and Pearson and WIMBA have worked very hard on the draft of this. So we really like the new approaches. And now I have implemented prototypes in both approaches, and I really like the new approach better. I mean, the stuff we had, you never like to throw code away, but then, you know, when the new stuff is, when you delete this much code, replace it with this much code, you say like, hey, that's kind of cool actually. So we started over, not exactly. Turns out that once we started looking at the Blackboard stuff, all the cool stuff from WIMBA, I'd say, I don't look quite like that. I kind of like this other way. And it turns out we knew it really well because we'd actually fully implemented its code and had working code. So talk a little bit about the technical bits and bytes. It's a protocol between what we call a proxy tool and an external tool. The proxy tool runs in the LMS. The external tool runs out on some server in the cloud somewhere. And really, it solves the problem of provisioning and configuration of tool placements, the launching of the tool and exchange of basic information, and then a series of web standardized web services for things like file exchange, grade exchange, and roster exchange. And the idea is by the time we're done with this, you should be able to write as rich a tool outside of an LMS as you can inside of an LMS. And everything we've done up to this point has not accomplished that. Again, PowerLinks, if you're familiar with WebCT, was the original inspiration, and the Blackboard proxy tool that's coming out in their next release is very much PowerLinks that's been building blockized, if that makes any sense. It takes a really elegant architecture that wasn't invented here and, you know, gets the same architecture to work in the way that feels good to the folks who architected building blocks. So this is what happens. You click on a tool. And I'll do this in a demo. You go to the proxy tool in the learning management system, but the tool itself doesn't really do the work. The tool then sends some web services, very simple web services. Here we stole this as much as we could from basic REST, as much REST style as we could, and as much Facebook style as we could. And then what comes back is some launch information, and then you send that launch information to the browser. There's three ways that it can be done. It can be done we actually have a widget capability where the thing actually returns some HTML to put in the background document. When you do that, you're really trusting that far end to just drop HTML into your background document. But again, we're designing a spec that we're trying to make powerful, not trying to solve all the world's problems in this spec, not trying to solve the security problems of cross-site scripting in this spec, because chances are good that most of the things you're going to mash up are servers that are sitting 1 foot away from each other in a rack, or even like one nanometer away from each other in the same RAM in a virtual server, where you're running a Sakai and a Moodle and a whatever all in the same box, and you're mashing these things up. So I guess you actually can trust those guys, and so why put iframes in if you can really trust those two servers that are right next to each other with the exact same system administrators? I guess if you're cross-site scripting yourself, well, I guess you deserve what you get at that point. So once this happens, whether it's in a div or an iframe or a pop-up, there is an interactive bit, and you know there's runtime services, and these runtime services are generally done in the name of the user because they know who the user is. We give them a kind of an encrypted session, much like the link tool. And they also can use any, if the external tool has some credentials that are more powerful than the user that have been granted out of band by the administrator, then it could do things perhaps that the user is not capable of doing. So one of my jobs at IMS is what we call the IMS Developer Network. And it's not really clear what that is, but my whole job is to get more geeks working with these specs as early as possible. We have this policy that says that you have to be a contributing member, which is the most expensive member, to participate in the working groups. And in addition, I had this Google Summer Code that I applied for and got. And so I was in a bad spot because I had a couple of students that were going to start working on this thing, and we had just changed directions in the document. And I thought we were going to be working on the WIMBA document, but instead we're working on sort of the Blackboard-inspired version. And so what I did is I quickly whipped up a document that I call Simple LTI, and it's a very light version of it. It's a subset of the real spec, and it is not an identical sub. It's not identical to the spec in any way, because that would be wrong if it was identical to the spec. What it is, it's very close to the spec, at least in its current draft, and when the spec comes out, as long as the spec stays on the course that it is, it will be extremely trivial to transform what we're doing to the spec. So I wanted to keep it separate. And, you know, Pearson has their stuff in production, and I have my stuff in production, and we all get together and argue about it, and I'm not going to win all the arguments, and so I can't expect that the spec is going to be exactly this. But I also picked on the simplest and most precious bit to me, and that is the provisioning and the launch. And so I built a test harness. I've got a test client, and I've got a test fake, I've got a fake LMS, and I've got a fake tool. So people building LMS tools can talk to a fake tool that's actually hosted in AppSpot. That's Google App Engine. So this is a little Python application I wrote and hosted for free from Google. Thank you very much. I wrote a 30-page developer specification. I'm trying to be like Facebook, right? You stumble into this, and like 2 hours later, you got something working. That's the whole idea. I got sample source code for both the client and server security bits in PHP, Perl, Python, and Java, and .NET. And it does all of the launch types, and it's pretty simple, pretty cool. This is just to give you an example of how easy it really is. This is the launch for Simple LTI, and it's very simple to similar to IMS LTI. It's just a form that gets auto-submitted by a set of JavaScript. If you've got JavaScript turned off, you see this little, if you're not redirected in 50 seconds, press here. And normally JavaScript's turned on, so it's kind of flash, and bingo, you're off to the site. And we just are being very REST-like. You just have a post URL. You've got some security bits, the first three parameters, sec nunt, sec created, and sec digest. And they're a security pattern that is not our pattern, but it's this OASIS pattern. The trick to this pattern is it's really neat because you don't have to exchange anything. You got a shared secret on both sides. And all you have to do is present evidence that you know the secret. So you basically pick some random numbers on one side, you encode the shared secret and random numbers all concatenated together, you give them like 2/3 of the string, but you don't give them the string, and on the far end, they add, if they know the secret, they add it to the string as well, then they encode that bit, and if the two encodings are the same, away we go. Now the only thing this is dangerous is the replay attack. And so the replay attack means if you've got a hold of this form, you could post it from anywhere. If you, because the secret's not here, but the material that was encoded with the secret is here. So it's the concept of nunce is what, I don't even know how to pronounce it, nunce. N-once, or just, it's a one-time key. And all you have to do is make sure that nunce is only accepted once, and then you're taking care of your replay attack, and you end up with this really easy security mechanism. And it's as secure as it needs to be. It's pretty awesome. Now, the other thing you'll notice in here is, oh, that's got bad user ID. I got to fix that documentation. Now that's because it's a Sakai example. And certain accounts in Sakai, their internal GUID that's supposed to be opaque is actually not so opaque, but now it's opaque on the slide. Okay, so when you look at user ID, you see some opaque identifier. And if you look at the course ID, you see some opaque identifier. And if you look at, you do get the role of this person. That's not opaque. And so you have to get the name through other mechanisms. And so this is sort of a deeply sandboxed thing. It's kind of shibboleth-like in that you're going to know that that user is the same user. You do know the role. We're asserting as the LMS. By signing this, the LMS is basically asserting that this person is the administrator. There's three roles, administrator, instructor, and student. And so you can kind of keep track of people, but you don't know their names. Now, if you're unsandboxed, you get more and more information. We'll see some unsand. Oh, so now it's time for demo. Okay, so this is my simple learning tools interoperability website that I'm using to teach developers how to do this. And hopefully I'm teaching developers how to do IMS tools interoperability when that finally comes out. Overview, blah, 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 like words, good words to read. Developer documentation. There's even a developer group which has like two people on it, me and Catherine, my summer code student. There's documentation, 25 pages of developer documentation, a big zip file of sample code and all kinds of languages. But the most important thing is that I've found in trying to get people to learn to use a new protocol is you have to have a test harness that's always there. And so we have a test client and a test server. So if you're using this, you just use, that's what you paste in, and then you paste this in as your secret, and then you can talk to my endpoint. And then I've got a client that is, so this is like the tool, and this is the learning management system. Now for now, I'm just gonna test talking to myself. And so the neatest thing about this test is it's just a form, because the whole thing is a form. Now I had to write a little bit of code to generate these random secrets, and see, these are properly generated. And if we wait too long, these secrets will expire because of time. But you also can see here, the required stuff is the stuff that is in bold, and the optional stuff, which you may or may not get depending on sandboxing, is in non-bold. And so the thing that's required is the nonce, the created, the digest. The secret is there just for testing. User ID, the user role, course ID, and a launch resource ID. So this means the external tools can keep track of effectively the placements in different LMSs and where they're coming from, et cetera, et cetera. And they can also use the URL and the secret to stash information about where this is coming from or who they handed this thing out to. But so the beauty of it, I mean, if you just look at this, it's just a... Oh. This is just a big form. And that's exactly what you do when you're calling it from an application, is you do the same form post. And of course, every language these days has this pretty much built in. And so so there's two kind of launches that you can do. You can do this launch HTML is just for debugging. The launch resolve says, I'm going to send you all this information, and you are either going to send me back a URL or some widget text to embed. And the launch direct says, I'm going to send you this stuff, and I'm going to have sent it from an iframe, and you just redirect to wherever you want. So the direct launch is, I'm going to post all this stuff to you, and you're already in the iframe. You just keep using that iframe. So it's like launch, redirect, go, and then you own that iframe from that point forward. Now, I don't actually redirect in this case. I sort of put debug things, and this is so that people who look at the source code can see what the security check is, and doing the hashing and checking and figuring out what the role is, and it says, oh, the time difference is greater than 30 seconds because I talked too long. So that was a security mismatch on that one. But that actually is just a warning on this particular tool. And so it would just naturally redirect to the content. My Google Summer Code student is tired of listening to my Dr. Chuck Sings the Blue video over and over and over again, because that's the only content that you get from this particular thing, is Dr. Chuck Sings the Blues. So that was a direct launch. If I go launch resolve and I say, okay, I'm going to say that I would like a widget back. My preference is to give me a widget if you can support it, then give me a post. If not, just give me, I can handle iframes, I can post to you, and I can do widgets. What widgets are is, now I have to view source because this is the real XML that you would get back. What you get back is real simple XML, But what you get back is HTML that you're supposed to drop into the background page. And so this happens to just be the object tag to Dr. Chuck Sings the Blues. But imagine, you know, it could be pointing back to the same server inside of a div, and then use AJAX or whatever to move stuff back and forth, or maybe JSON to move stuff back and forth. And sometimes, actually, these external tools will actually themselves make an iframe, but then they make it exactly the right size, and that's a lot of these things. Like Google Maps is using an iframe. It just doesn't look like an iframe because the Google Maps people make the iframe, know how big the iframe is, and then make sure that their content never exceeds the iframe, so it just looks a lot better than sometimes Sakai doesn't. The tool doesn't know how big the iframe is, or it doesn't smartly size itself. But the whole thing of the widget is you could put it in the background. It could be an applet tag, right? This could just be an applet that comes from that other server. If you trust it, then bingo, you're running that applet right in the background. Again, there's a lot of trust issues here, but the protocol allows these really, really intimate mashups to happen, potentially multiple mashups on the same page, just mashy, mash, 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 and this widget mashup is an important part of that. Okay, so that's the demo of the test harness. By the way, you can ask questions if you like. I like questions, but you don't have to. Well, just ask anytime you want. Okay, so that's the first demo. So what triggered this was the IMS Sakai Google Summer Code. For those of you not familiar with it, it's a real cool thing. And Google Summer Code basically is they're trying to take young people and get them into open source communities. That's really what they're trying to do. And so the bait is that they will pay a student selected for this $5,000 over the summer so that they don't have to get another job. They're supposed to work full time for a mentor, and then that to do something for an open source community. And we'd never done this before. And I don't quite know what got me started at the right moment, but like a week before the deadline, I said, let's do this. And so I worked with Rob Abel of IMS and Michael Korpuska from Sakai, and we put in a real nice application. And you know, for being total newbies, we actually turned out pretty well. And basically, my proposal was that, you know, no one's going to build these IMS tool interoperability things just kind of randomly because there's a chicken and egg problem. There's no tools, then there's no one needs to mash them up. If there's nothing to mash up, why do you need to mash up, right? And so the idea was to say, let's just try to build these and use student labor to build these things. And I was hoping to make some synergy, enough synergy to make it worth people's while. So I got three Google Summer Codes. Catherine Edwards of McGill University is working on a Sakai proposal to effectively add full support for IMS Learning Tools interoperability to Sakai. And I've got a person from Barcelona that I'm going to go down tomorrow and meet with, who is his advisor is one of the top Moodle committers, and they're working on exporting the Moodle tools through tools interoperability. And so you can kind of see the picture here, right? We have Sakai able to read and produce. We have Moodle able to pull in and produce. Kind of interesting. I got another one that was just a Sakai one that he's working on presence. Eli Foley of Georgia Tech. So basically, the plan for this summer for Moodle is to make it so that Moodle acts as an external tool provider. So that means that all the Moodle tools can be used in anything, including SharePoint, that could consume this IMS LTI. We'll make a simple LTI tool, just a little Moodle module that you can add to add resource, and at least you can put an LTI, you can put a URL and a secret into it, and poof, it'll comply with the same things that the thing. And so if somebody starts building a tool out there, then it goes into Moodle for free. They don't have to write their own Moodle plugin. They just use our Moodle plugin and our protocol and away.
How do you handle the fact that Moodle wants a profile?
A profile for what?
Anyone coming in.
You mean...
I want to come in using Moodle discussions.
Moodle
wants to know who I am, and it makes a profile record for me.
That's the same problem in Sakai. It's the same problem in Sakai.
Yeah, of course.
Okay? So it actually turns out to be a really icky problem. It was one of my most feared problems. So the question is, how do you get in sort of the back door if you've never came in through the front door?
Right. And I mean,
right?
I looked through the Moodle code, and I found, you know, a number of different places where it was doing this. I wanted to find one consistent place where I could poke code and, hey, go back and ask Sakai.
they're going to do it. These guys are going to do it. Oh, that's the problem. Guys. Yeah, the Moodle guys are going to do it. Oh. Not Martin, but you know these guys that they're writing the Moodle Wiki actually.
So they're going to make Moodle proper.
Yeah, and that turns out to be the hardest problem. It turns out to be a hard problem. Well, luckily in Sakai, our structures are a little more friendly.
Organized.
Well, yeah, but yeah, our data structures are. I mean, you might have to catch it a bunch of places, but at some point they can make a profile. So the thing that you do is once you know this unique human being, you make them a profile. So what we're going to do in Sakai is, you know how we have enterprise IDs and UIDs, you know the enterprise ID is kind of like your Kerberos or your CAS or your whatever, right? So if you're coming in through Sakai's tool interoperability, it's really a multi-tenancy situation. We think of it as a different source of enterprise IDs. And potentially every site that you're going to is now a different source of site of IDs. So you might actually get more UIDs than you might end up, if you are coming in the front door, you get one UID. If you come in the back door here, here, and here, you might actually get three more UIDs. So we're not going to necessarily try to connect those identities because you just don't know in the cloud who's coming in. So I might be CSEV coming in the front door. Kerberos asserts that I'm CSEV. I'm not going to trust some dude that says, here comes CSEV from Moodle or whatever. And so I'll trust that if your email is, if your first name's Chuck and you say that, the next time you come, I'll say, hi, Chuck. But I'm not going to let you take over the account of the Kerberos guy named CSEV.
Right.
And so you don't notice this. You just end up with these memberships. Now, we're going to make it, thanks to the kind of some Berkeley work and when we first did the UID, EID work, you won't see it in the user interface at all in Sakai. So it turns out it's easy in Sakai, but a lot of applications assume a single authoritative source of identity. And then they display that all throughout their thing. Sakai doesn't. So Sakai's easy. Moodle might be a little hard. We'll see how bad it is this weekend when we sit around a bodega and start drawing some pictures. But these guys are the ones that are adding web services to Moodle, which of course is a different problem where Moodle doesn't, again, because they don't have, you know, APIs and everything, it's not the same. But these are the guys that go after problems like that in Moodle, for Moodle, you know, within that community. So it's not like I'm going to go try to figure out how to do this. It's the people who've been fighting with that for a long time. So the other thing we're going to do is add a thing that I've never used Moodle, but they have these things called filters, I'm told, where you put, like, inside of a editor, you put this bracket syntax, and you give it a couple of parameters. And so you'll be able, in the middle of a wiki entry, put this bracket LTI, put a URL and a secret, and then there she shows up. Now, you know, if it's an iframe or hopefully in the background, but it starts allowing you to write a wiki page and put like three little tools in that wiki page that are coming from elsewhere. Okay, that's starting to look interesting because it's not just placing a tool now, it's actually placing a tool within the middle of a wiki page. So Catherine got started earlier from McGill, and so she's already, she's pretty amazing. She's my favorite kind of employee. I'll be getting ready for bed. I think I owe Catherine a really long design document about how to do something. But it's too late. I'm tired. I can't do this. So I'll write Catherine like a short two-sentence explanation of the design document I'm promising to give her tomorrow, right? And I'll say, okay, Karen, we need to kind of stick a web service in, and it's got to make new users, and it's got to append the UID like this, like three sentences or whatever. So I send that at like 11 o'clock at night. And then, you know, the next day goes by, and I never get the document written. And I'm like, Catherine, I'm sorry that I didn't get you the spec. I promise I'll get you the spec tomorrow. She goes, no, I'm already done. I checked that in. This is my kind of employee, right? So I just kind of give her these vague notions. And I say, Catherine, how'd you figure that out so fast? I looked at a lot of code. It's like, yeah. So she's going to fit right in. You're going to like her a lot when she, we're going to try to keep her. And that's the whole idea of Google Summer Code is you get them to stay. They don't just come, spend their summer, and leave. They come, spend their summer, and she can be like the chief committer for Access 2 from now on. That's cool. So she'll be making web services for us. And so I introduced her on the dev list, and just be nice to her because we hope she sticks around. And you know, she's got a long working life because she's, I don't know, 23 or something. And so that's cool. So she's already got Sakai acting like a simple external tool provider. It makes users. It finds sites. It doesn't respect security yet because you can't get that. And what she's working on right now is a tool that's kind of like a page order tool that allows you to set whether or not you want tool interoperability to work on each tool in your site, and then put secrets and then change the secrets. So it's the thing to say, go mash this tool up somewhere else, grab this URL and this secret, and put it over there. So she's building that right now. I have built a complete, effectively production-ready proxy tool that reads LTI sitting in Contrib right now, and it even has features to try to steal all the customer base of the link tool. I've actually got some things where if you've got a tool that's talking to the link tool style web services, I send you the same bits of information that you need, the Sakai session, the signed Sakai session, etc. So I'll show you what we've got going in Sakai, me and Catherine. So here's the proxy tool. Oh yeah, there's me again. But that's not the fun bit. Here is basically the configuration screen. The only thing you have to do, wrong tab key. So if I'm going to go back to my little LTI test environment, testing, it says, oh, you can launch requests to this URL. Come back. So there's the URL that I got to paste in, and I type the password secret. So at this point, I click Update Options. Now I can set a bunch of things, like change the page title, tool title. That's all inside Sakai. Resource URL is this little extension that we can actually send the tool a file URL if we like. I'm going to prefer the widget launch, so it drops right into the no iframes. And then you can also tell it a preferred height and width. So you can say, look, little Google Maps, I want you to be this big. That would be most useful for the widget, but it could also be useful for an iframe tool where you're giving it a clue as to how big the iframe is that you're going to set. And then when you're using iframes and you say the iframe height, it then tells the external tool what the iframe height is. So I'll just update options now. We're all developers in the room here. We can watch the log go by. And I'm fixing my portal performance test thing too, so you might see some of those error messages going by. Okay, so that all worked. It sent it made a bunch of stuff. It read some properties. That was saving all that stuff. Then it sent a form. And this is all the form parameters here. Now I'm not sandboxing it, so it sent pretty much everything I've got. It got back a widget response, and then when I finally say yes, it comes in, and if you were to view source, because this is a JSR 168 portlet, it does not use a frame, and because I've used a widget launch on the external tool, the LTI is not using a frame, and so that's effectively an object tag in the background document. With the only iframe left in this is the presence, and of course Eli's working on that. And so that's sort of the widget launch. And I could put three of those on the same page if I felt like it. Okay? So that's one side of the Sakai thing. And I think Catherine, unlike me, she comments out her print statements before she checks code in. I don't do that. So let's go to talk to Catherine now, and I will show you. It won't be very exciting, but you're all smart enough to realize how exciting this really is. Come on. Let's talk to Catherine's code. Yeah, it's only fair that I would take the flashy thing and I would make that be the part that I would write, and then the kind of ugly, hard part, that's what Catherine has to write. So basically I can make this form, and instead of posting, I got to do something else here. I got to find a tool ID. Come back. I got to get a tool ID. Open a new tab. Now this is the part where when she gets to... I didn't want that. Stop. Let's do it this way. I got to get a tool ID, and unfortunately, we don't have the tool she's written that would give me this URL. Open frame and new tab. That's what I want. It's all based on tool ID. but we'll probably come up with some short URL version of this. So I got to go to her Access to Web Service, and I got to give it the tool ID, and I'm using the Site Info tool from the site that I'm using. Now, this isn't actually going to submit the data. It just gives me a form that allows me to submit any data I want now, but it's going to submit to that URL instead of my loopback URL that's running on the Google App Engine. So we'll do them all. We'll do Launch Resolve, which is going to give me back. This is okay. So that was amazing. Yeah, congratulations, Catherine. You did great. And so basically what this is, now she's not, I think she's just giving me back YouTube still, but you'll see there, she's also got Sakai Session. Let's see, yeah, and it's going to YouTube. I don't know why she hasn't changed that yet, but she's got she's made a Sakai Session, she's created a user, she's given me back a URL that is basically a direct launch that would go right to Site Info, and the code's pretty straightforward and pretty solid. We just got to get to the point where it checks security before it goes ahead and does all these things so that you're actually permitting these people into your site. And so, yeah, so I've shown Sakai consuming from my external Python tool, and I've shown the external Python tool consuming from Sakai. And so that's, you know, a work in process that is going pretty much, you know, every day is making progress. So now I just want to close with the standard Chuck Severance crazy ideas and plans. There's no guarantee that any of this is ever going to happen. But if you look back, surprisingly large amounts of it do happen as long as, you know, you got a tailwind and whatever. So I'm currently working with two publishers who are interested in adding support, not waiting for IMS LTI, but they're going to add simple LTI to sort of some test environments. One of the things I've learned doing this is the power of screenshots, because if they can do something like in 2 days and walk around the next few months to higher management with some screenshots of showing how they plugged into Blackboard for free, then all of a sudden people start thinking at higher management that they ought to spend some money on this. And so I don't care that the standard's not finished. I want to show screenshots that they can kind of blur their eyes and say, look, we ought to join this group and we ought to work on this and we ought to make sure that when this thing comes out of the gate, we're ready as a publisher. So I got two publishers that are pretty hot on doing this, and not necessarily Sakai. It may or may not be Sakai. I don't really care. I really just love to see publishers in this space and playing around. Just writing a Blackboard building block. They're not that hard to do. Wimba's got some code that they may give to me, and I just it talks the old Wimba protocol, but I'll switch it to this new one, which is actually mostly deleting code. I want to write a Sakai wiki macro. So imagine you're in the wiki and you say bracket LTI bracket and you put a URL and a secret in, blammo, right there it goes, right in the middle. A resource handler. The resource handler in Sakai is the thing that when you do add resource and you see forms down there or file or folder forms, you can extend that in Sakai. I could say add LTI. And up you'd say, give me the URL, set that, 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 and now all of a sudden you're doing the same launching from resources rather than from the left-hand menu. I'll probably end up building a little LTI widget for the MyCam tools, that HTML JavaScript that the Ian and crew are working on, because it fits right in, especially the widget. It's not harmful. It's going to fit right into that. And I'd like to get, when Malaite settles down, I'd like to drop this in to make it a resource type in Malaite as well. I don't know if you saw the Katana work by McGraw-Hill. McGraw-Hill had to... The only thing they really added to Malaite at the end of the day was some of their own proprietary digital rights management. And it turns out that they did exactly what this is. They just happened to do it themselves. They did it before this existed. And so it's entirely possible that the way we could bring Malaite and Katana back together is just add better digital rights management to Malaite, and then they just can comply with this, and then all of a sudden Katana drops into any Malaite rather than having to have a special Malaite. So basically adding an IMS LTI a resource type. The McGraw-Hill is kind of unique in that it doesn't need to know who you are or what you are. It does no tracking or anything like that. The McGraw-Hill just needs a GUID basically of who you are, so you can check your PIN code and then say this GUID's good. And it's sort of like the perfect shibboleth, you know, anonymous. We don't need to know who you are. You just have to pay money and prove that you paid, and we don't care anything else about you. We're not going to send grades back. So the IMS LTI group is, I'm happy to report, going very strong. Blackboard's working very hard in the group. Pearson is working very hard in the group. WIMB is working very hard in the group. I'm working very hard in the group. It's moving very rapidly. And 8 weeks ago, I was pretty depressed because we threw away all that prototype code. But frankly, the reason it's moving so rapidly is that based on that prototype code, we know what ideas are good and what ideas are bad, and we can make decisions amazingly rapidly as we evolve the spec forward. If you're a IMS member and you would like to get under the covers, just get a hold of us and we'll plug you in. You got to sign some secret-y things, but it's actually one of the more fun specs that I've worked on. I like them when they're moving fast. It's fast is sort of my middle name. The current spec that I've got is very nice to work with, and the IMS LTI spec is nice as well. It's easy. The code to write in any language is actually quite clean and easy. I've been beating on this horse for a long time. I mean, we were doing this in 2005 in AltiLab, where we were doing functionality mashup, but the market just couldn't go yet. And so I got this. This is the optimistic year for me. And so my goal is this time next year to have the spec out and multiple implementations in the marketplace. My sub-goal is to have some bits in production at a few places, even as early as this fall, using kind of my early version of the spec. We at Michigan have at least two tools that we're going to run this way in the fall in production, if all goes well. And that's part of the reason I have a production-ready LTI consumer, because we have a couple of external tools that we're going to plug in using this mechanism rather than using Link tool. In this way, it's really very equivalent to Link tool, but a little bit cleaner than Link tool. And so we got a extremely complex homework management system that the physics people can't live without, that's got clickers integrated. I mean, it's just like, we're never going to get that feature into Sakai. So we might as well just let those Perl people keep doing that clicker stuff that they've been doing, and then just launch them into these nice little screens so they can check their grades, the teachers can get in. And get little grade dashboards for the physics kids. They can go see the physics stuff. That's one application we're pulling in through Tools Interoperability at Michigan. The second application is a thing called SiteMaker, which is, it's kind of like SUSE. It's kind of like CamTools. It's a thing that takes rectangles and moves them around and stores data, and you know, there's only like a million ways to author. That's why we have a content authoring VAUG. Except that there's a whole bunch of people that are addicted to this particular one, but it's written in Apple's Web Objects, and it's very important to the University of Michigan. We're like the biggest user of it. And we got a bunch of people that do a lot of their basic web building. It's kind of like a Joomla or Mambo for the University of Michigan. And, you know, we've been thinking about rewriting this thing for the longest time in Sakai, and finally it's like, just leave it in Web Objects. We'll plug it in and use it. And you may find that at your schools that it's, and again, it's very similar to Link tool, but it's a little cleaner than Link tool. And so you might find, if you're starting a project, that you might use Link tool, you might consider getting a hold of me or going to that website and using this instead. Okay, I think I'm done. How much time do I have? Holy crap. Well, I started like late. Any couple questions? Ah, Ian. Uh-oh. Did you ask me that question a long time ago on the mailing list?
I don't know.
Okay, because this is deja vu. That very same question must have gone through the working group like within the last couple of weeks.
Okay.
And so I think they looked at Google Widgets. Not Google Widgets, the W3C. The W3C spec, and felt informed by it, felt that it wasn't close enough. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'd love, you know, if you take a look at this and you can tell me how to influence that conversation, I'm really agnostic on this, and I even things like what we name the forms, steal them from anywhere. I don't, you know, just to get closer to harmonizing with something else would be great. So if you have any suggestion that maybe you know more. I didn't look closely. I took a brief look at widgets, and then the folks from Blackboard and Pearson looked at it, and they felt it wasn't quite where we wanted to go. But
did you look at it all?
No. Well, oh, that's right. I heard about it, but I didn't look at it.
I was the Flickr launch protocol.
Yeah. Help me. Help me. Any other questions?
If you're doing Moodle integration, we're trying to do a lot of Moodle and Sakai integration. Someone we could collaborate with, maybe Sean.
Well, I'll see what these guys talk about. And frankly, if you could be identified as an early customer of the Moodle Google Summer Code Work, because you're strong kind of in both, I bet they'd love to talk to you. So, I mean, I know how to get a hold of you. And basically, they'll start shouting on the web, on our dev list as well, once they get up to speed. Their semester just stopped like a week and a half ago, and so that's why they're not up to speed yet. So, yeah, it'd be great to just have a little poster child for a little Moodle Sakai plugin going on. Yeah. I'm guessing the Moodle will be a little harder.
Moodle is going to be hard. Yeah. One of the big things that James promised.
He did?
Yeah,
he had. Excellent. Excellent.
In order
to sell. Yeah. Yeah, that's the dream, right? Plug them all together. Okay, well, I thank you for your time, and I'll, of course, be around for questions and anything. Thank you.